Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The movie All Things Must Pass is a multi-generational story of music, greed, lust, power. It's not Empire. It's the story of Tower Records and its director, who should have been on the show a long time ago, but has finally joined me here, Colin Hanks. First of all, thanks so much for being here, Colin.
Thanks for having me, Elvis. Nice to see you.
But it is, it's a multi-generational story about shifts in pop culture.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tower, for lack of a better phrase, really does represent the music industry or the retail industry as we knew it. It was there at the beginning, and it was sort of the first visual casualty that common people saw and went, oh, wow, yeah, okay, things are changing now. Things really are different. And Russ Solomon and the people that worked at Tower, they were there for the whole thing, the whole ride. So it's multi-generational for music. It's multi-generational for the family of Tower, and it most definitely was a family.
Because it really starts with the founder's father having a pharmacy where they started to sell used records.
And that was...
in Sacramento.
That was the moment when I had the light bulb moment of... this is a documentary, because I found that out probably a week or so before the stores were closing. I was having dinner with an old family friend of mine from Sacramento. And
you used to go to the Sacramento stores.
I grew up in Sacramento. I spent all my money in Tower Records. I bought my first concert ticket at Tower Records.
What was that?
March 5th, 1990, Tom Petty playing on the Full Moon Fever tour with the Heartbreakers as the backing band, even though it was a solo tour. Lenny Kravitz opened up. Bought it at 16th and Broadway.
Got to ask you, so the first record you bought there?
The first record that I really bought with my money was that was really, truly important and life-changing was Blood Sugar Sex Magik by the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Okay.
It came in a long box. I bought it at Tower Records. And I remember because I used to take an X-Acto knife and cut off
the long box being where they put the original CD holders.
And put it on the wall as a poster in my room, yeah.
For those of you listening under 20, a CD... it's something that your older brother and sister now use as coasters because they don't play music on them anymore. But as I was watching the film, before we get back to the history of Tower, and I see you wearing your No Music, No Life, which I saw in the Tokyo Show, which I was telling you about before. As I watch this, because it's about the end of an era, I actually find myself thinking a little bit about That Thing You Do.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the era, you know? I mean, when Tower really comes to prominence, it's and Tower Records, as we know it truly, started was in 1960. And that was the dawn of, you know, pop music.
As you say in the film, is basically it's the Beach Boys that really kicked Tower off.
Yeah. Oh, in California, most definitely. And
which also kind of reaffirms the fact that Tower was a California store.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It was a California store. You know, everyone thinks that their Tower was first, you know, New York, San Francisco, L.A., but it really is California, and it is Sacramento. And, you know, it had, you know, this start in this, you know, classic Americana drugstore where they were selling used 78s out of a old Wurlitzer jukebox. And then once they get into, you know, the 60s and the pop culture movement, you know, the 45 RPM records, well, things just go from there. And Russ Solomon, the founder, he's the first one to tell you it was all luck and timing because he had no way to be able to plan for this. He didn't think that, you know, you can't plan for the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Beach Boys and kids coming in with, you know, disposable income. You can't plan for that kind of stuff.
I got to ask you, because just knowing you a little bit and knowing the kind of things that interest you, that intersection of popular culture and passion is what this is about. But this is that added element to the equation of commerce. I mean, it's these things that you don't really think about. You think about pop culture and passion being these things that belong to people. But all these Tower stores became these weird kind of islands that attracted these people who were about these things. didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, this whole process of making this film has been incredibly eye-opening to me, because there were certain tenets of Tower that I was not necessarily, you know, I didn't know at the time, but when I look back on my experience in the store, is what hooked me. You know, Tower was really founded on these tenets of have a deep inventory, you know, deep catalogs. So we're not talking about just the most popular record by an artist. We're talking about their whole catalog, if it's possible. Every single kind of music you could possibly imagine. A knowledgeable staff that dresses the way they want to dress, you know, talks the way they want to talk, or not talk sometimes, or grunt, depends. And a store in which they're not going to force you to buy anything. You can go and hang out for as long as you want, and if you don't buy anything, that's not a bad thing. Now, I experienced this as a kid, as a shopper at the store, and I didn't think anything of it. But now that we look, now that I look back on it, that's revolutionary.
It makes me wonder, did you ever see the film Empire Records?
Of course. It was written by a former Tower Records employee.
That's why I bring this up. I figured you did, because it's also a movie about the end of an era, about a store like Towers being forced out, being forced out of business. And for you, being the age you are, you basically were coming around at the end of the music era in some ways. I mean...
Yes. My experience was in the early 90s, in the CD era. But... the eras are the exact same. It's the same journey. It's the same process, you know. The difference for me is I was that last generation. And one of the very first questions I asked Russ, I said, if you had to pinpoint one thing in this whole gnarly mess of Napster and overexpansion and all of these things, if you could pinpoint one thing that you really felt was the root problem, the root cause of all of this stuff. He said it was when they stopped selling singles. When the music industry cut out the singles market, you lost an entire generation of kids just coming into a store because they were no longer interested. They couldn't afford to buy an $18 or $20 CD. But, you know, I was that last generation that I went in and bought, you know, cassette singles. You want the embarrassing one? I bought EMF Unbelievable. It came in. They were a one-hit wonder. At the time, yeah, you had to be. And now I know what it means to be able to say you had to be there.
Yeah, I'm afraid I know what that is, too. It's the treatment. My guess is Colin Hanks, who's showing that he's a living anachronism. His documentary, All Things Must Pass, is not just a film about Tower Records, but also a film about a moment of popular culture that extended for so long that people didn't actually see an end for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it would come. It looked like it was about to die. Mm-hmm. You make the point of the film that disco looks like it's about to cut the record industry, but it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
CDs look like they're about to cut off the retail record industry, but they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are so many interesting stop and starts. It's like the sort of the false end of a song.
Yeah.
And I wonder, in this telling of the story, if you notice that too, that every time that they thought the industry is about to die, it didn't. I mean, you just mentioned Russ, the founder of the store, who's a big part of this film, this family is too, saying that he thought that the 45, or really the death of the 45 killed it. But again, every time it looked like the retail music industry had been dealt a body blow,
mm-hmm.
it recovered and bigger than ever.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing that I really wanted to make sure that we were able to tackle, aside from the personal stories of everybody, you know, in the film, but I wanted to pop that bubble of this very simplistic notion that it was quite simply just Napster that killed Tower. That's part of it, without a doubt, but that's not the sole reason. And a lot of the components of the ultimate, you know, demise of Tower are really, you know, there. It's a couple of different factors that all play together. One was, you know, the death of the singles. You know, you lose a generation of kids coming in. Well, that's the same generation of kids that are then in college when Napster comes out. Okay, so there's that. Those things are obviously connected. There's the introduction of the CD. Okay, well, that was a revolutionary piece of technology at that time, and it ended up becoming a huge chunk of the music industry because it was basically just people rebuying their collection.
And an enormous profit to the record
industry.
Because the profit, the money it took to make a CD versus what they charge for it.
Yeah, oh.
That's what I feel really killed the record industry.
Yeah, well, because you can't prop an entire industry up on that, because what are you going to do when everyone's bought their collection?
Again.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
What, are you going to do this every single time something new comes out? Eventually, people are going to, you know, really start crying foul about this kind of stuff. Then there's also the more personal stuff within Tower. There's the overexpansion, the debt that they took on, the hubris that they had, as well as the, you know, both actual family, you know, squabbles, as well as the proverbial Tower family squabbles, and how all of those things, you know, all of those things together really paints the true picture of why Tower really, really left. And that was something that I found very, very fascinating, because...
Is that you connected to first the idea, all these sort of really, these personal connections to the store, and how everybody in this finally has a different point of view about this?
Well, yeah. I mean, everybody's been very surprised at how human the story actually is, which was not necessarily my intention when I first started out. But once I met Russ and he insisted that it wasn't just his story, that it was a group of, you know, people that gathered around that really helped make Tower what it was, and he was just the guy that was smart enough to hire them, and he insisted that we speak with them, that then it became much more of a human story and a much more personal story about these people. So really, I then had to find that balancing act between their story and then the more historical, you know, portion of the film where we're able to explain what really happened and making sure that both are interesting.
How did you pitch it to him? How did you tell him you wanted him to be a part of this and that you were doing a film on Tower Records?
Well, luckily there we found an introduction through my friend's dentist. Gives you an idea of a little bit of, you know, Sacramento. We do things a little bit differently from Sacramento. But we said, look, we'd love to get a chance to sit down and talk with you because we think this would be a very engaging and fun documentary. And I don't even remember what my pitch was to him. I don't even remember what I said to him, but he obviously saw that we were incredibly passionate. And he said, well, first, he said, you guys are crazy. He then said, I will amend this. He said, you guys are crazy. You'll never make any money, but let's do it.
So the story of Tower Records.
It was kind of the story of Tower Records. And then he said, but, you know, you can't just talk with me. It's really all about, you know, these kids. It's the Stan Gomans, the Mark Vitasiches, the Heidi Kotlers, the Ken Sokoloffs, you know, all the people that we spoke to in the film. And there were a lot more that we couldn't get to, we wanted to. But he really was very insistent that it was their story. And that was the moment where I realized that Tower really was an incredibly unique place to work and a place to be at. And that's when the film really started to take on a life of its own. And then at that point, it just kept getting deeper and more emotionally involved and personal. And that's when we were like, okay, we really have to tell this story. This isn't just something that I find interesting that no one else will. This is an actual tale that needs to be told.
We'll take a break. The lesson we learned so far, find a dentist, not just invest in the film, but to point you in the right direction. My guest is Colin Hanks. His first film as documentary director is All Things Must Pass. We'll talk about that title and more after this. Stay with us.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. Again, find yourself a dentist. My guest is Colin Hanks. His film as director is the documentary All Things Must Pass. First of all, where's the title come from? We know what that title represents, yeah, but why'd you pick it?
Early on in the process, someone asked me, what's the theme of your documentary? And I had no idea. I had no answer for them. I was still sort of
I thought you listened to the show. Don't you know? There's always a theme to what you do.
Well, I was still figuring it out in my mind and still talking it out. And I went up to Sacramento on that trip to go see Russ. And on a lark, I figured I'd go drive by the old Watt Avenue store, which wasn't really in my neighborhood. I didn't really go to that store very much until I had a driver's license. And once I did, I was there quite a bit. And I drove by. The store had been closed for 2 years by that point. And the sign was still up. And the store was sitting there old and dusty. I mean, all the racks and everything was still there. And there was an announcement sort of placard on the front of the building where they would announce, you know, records coming out and stuff like that. And one of the employees of that store had put up "All Things Must Pass, Thanks Sacramento." And again, you know, it's funny how these moments kind of happen where you just go, oh my goodness, that's my theme right there. That eventually, all things got to end, man. The party's got to end sometime, you know. You know, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. That kind of thing. And, you know, obviously the musical reference was great. It was also an important thing, too, because the one on the Sunset Store, they had put up, "It's the end of the world as we know it." But they left out the following line, which is, and I feel fine.
Yeah.
Which I was like, nice try, but that's a swing and a miss. But the really great thing, though, too, is once that became the theme, we then kept seeing these instances where it was almost like a karmic fate that this film was named that. There's footage of the Sunset Store that that we found, that we digitized and is in the film. And it's a film from the day that All Things Must Pass was released. And so there's footage in the film of them stocking the vinyl record of All Things Must Pass. There's footage of people buying the All Things Must Pass record in the film. That, when we noticed that, we were like, oh, that's a little spooky. And then maybe about 2 years later, because that's how long it's taken, you know, it's taken a long time to make the film. 2 years later, we were looking at this one photo. We've seen it a million times. It's Russ and a bunch of employees in the store. We cut to it two times in the film. All of a sudden, we realized right in between Russ and one of the employees is like last three letters of George's first name and the first two letters of his last name. And we were just like, oh my, this is too weird. This is too weird. And so then we just started putting in as many references as we could.
Well, apropos of that, sure, I get that. But apropos of that, I mean, there's a radio commercial at one point that runs in the film, and you have it basically in its entirety, because you hear it, you go, that voice sounds familiar. Mm. And that voice turns out to be the voice of
John Lennon. And not only is it that John Lennon, he did two versions of that. He did the straightforward, you know, hello, this is John Lennon.
They did that basically that rock and roll version that you could put in the film.
But then he did the crazy version, the John Lennon version of him like really losing himself and, you know, being like Elvis. I said, that's the one we need to use. The other interesting thing, and we were talking about this earlier, the fact that, you know, this All Things Must Pass. One of the important things to realize when we're talking about sort of the hubris element of this is they almost had, when you think about it, almost every right to feel invincible, because there was not a year from 1960 until around 1999 that they did not make money.
And again, set that statistic the film begins with from 1999. How much money had they made?
They had about $1 billion worth of business.
And in 2005?
They filed for bankruptcy. That's crazy. I mean, that alone is a pretty staggering statistic. And you realize that when you are constantly making money for that long, for decades.
And again, dodging the bullet every time, basically people will put the pennies on
every
your
time,
eyes.
Every time, yeah. Like,
fill out the
desk are they going to dig these CDs? Oh, they really dig these CDs. Let's go in on the CD. You know, are they going to do all these things?
Oh, we're shifting from 45s to albums? Oh, nobody's going to buy those.
Yeah. I mean, all these things, they just felt sort of invincible. And so when you see, you know, there's a scene in the film that comes from a corporate video. It's a staged interview with Russ, and they're talking about this, you know, space age concept of beaming music into one's home. You understand why he would say, you know, what he does. And he says, yeah, you know, these things may come around, but they'll come around over a long period of time and we'll be able to adjust, because that's how everything had been prior to that. Every change in the music industry for the prior 30 years had come by kind of slowly, and it had chance to grow. And this space age concept that now is commonly referred to as the internet, that was just so damn quick. They couldn't adjust. They simply could not adjust. And so, you know,
it's the treatment that I'm having on the only guest who's ever interviewed me before, and that's Colin Hanks' new film. His great documentary is All Things Must Pass. I guess the thing, though, I feel like I want to ask you about is it feels like It's a film about basically two halves, sort of like almost the id and the superego, and about the way that these things are sort of in constant battle with each other, you know, because there was Bud Martin, who was a guy who said, you know, you can't act this way. You can't spend this money that you don't have. You can't start a store in Tokyo, which turned out to be the thing that, had they been able to keep it, would have kept the store alive. But also, at some point, even he gets sort of subsumed by this. Mm-hmm. Even he's buying, like, a Ferrari every year and wearing Hawaiian shirts. Yeah. And at a certain point, to me, it felt like pop and the passion that pop evokes became this contagion.
Yeah.
And the movie's kind of about that, that once you're infected by it, you're infected by it.
That rock and roll lifestyle, for sure. You know, I mean, one of the original sort of concepts that I was working on was that Tower really represented these people that were on the fringes of rock and roll, you know, that classic, that not necessarily, you know, rock and roll music, but that music industry, fun time. And so these are the people that were in the trenches, you know, really living it day in, day out. They didn't maybe necessarily know how to play guitars or sing or any of that stuff, but they were able to live that experience, have that experience. That's a lot of fun. And there's no doubt about that. And we explore all of that in the film. And there is some, you know, debaucherous fun that was had at Tower Records, without a doubt. But in order for anything to really work and to run well and be efficient, there has to be a yin to the yang. There has to be. And Bud Martin was that for Russ. Bud was more straight-laced than Russ was. He wasn't as outgoing. He was a proper businessman. I mean, he was an accountant. But an accountant, you know, that's not, he's not a dentist. He's more exciting than that, maybe. Going back to the dentist thing.
This is what we call a theme.
Or a callback, one of the two. I don't know.
I don't know you kids in your comedy terms.
But you need to have that balance. You know, as I really sat down with Stephen Leckhart, our writer, and Darren Roberts, our editor, and we were talking about, you know, ways that we could really form our narrative, Bud really was a challenge because we didn't have much footage of him. We didn't have many pictures of him. He's no longer living, so we can't really interview him to get his side of the story. And so we needed to get a sense of who he was from the people that we did speak to, and trying to create that presence within the film, because when he leaves the company, things really start unraveling. And then when he dies unexpectedly, that really is the signal that Towers is not much longer for the world either.
It's actually missing one of its pillars. I mean, because you did need those two sort of poles between Russ and Bud. But I also like too the fact that the film has a definitive three act structure, rather, and the second act is the introduction of the Sunset Store, which is the thing that really sort of, I mean, one of the things that doesn't get mentioned in the film, but David Geffen is one of your interview subjects, and his offices were always right down the street from Tower. I mean, he could walk to Tower.
Yeah.
I mean, Geffen Records was basically half a mile away.
Was right there.
Yeah, like half a mile west of the store. Mm-hmm. But what you do say in the film is, I think, really interesting, is that proximity to everything. But also, there in a lot of, like, there might be in fashion or the what there would be in movies, this wall that separates those who make it from the fans. That doesn't exist in the music world. You have Bruce Springsteen in the film talking about how it was this island that you ended up on, and you could go there. And then that Elton John would go in there. Certainly, they opened the store for him early with his checklist. But he'd also go in there during regular business hours. As somebody who shopped in that store, I can talk about the people you saw in that store.
Yeah, absolutely. It was... The thing that I think I really appreciate about Tower is the fact that, once those doors opened, everyone was welcome and everyone was on equal ground. And it didn't matter if you were the world's biggest music, star, the best guitar player in the world.
Like Elton John again.
That didn't matter. When you were in Tower, it was a safe place for them, where they could hang out and not be bothered, and they can be just like everybody else and be a music fan just like everybody else. And the people that were in there who saw, the Elton Johns and, the Dave Grohls of the world,
Dave Grohl, by the way, who, as you mentioned, worked at the store.
An employee, yeah. Well, that was very specific. I specifically wanted that because you know, we were a small independent documentary film. And so that was what I called my golden twofer, because he was not only a famous talking head, but he also worked at the store. So that's two birds with one stone. David Geffen heard that I was making this documentary. I had heard the story from Stan Gohman about, you know, how often Dave would come into the store and him, you know, Geffen taking Stan up to his house to go listen to the first Eagles pressing. I said, well, I'll try and get Dave Geffen. I asked him, and he said, really? You want me in the documentary? I said, yes, because David Geffen still thinks that no one wants to hear what he has to say, even though he's the most fascinating man I've ever met. Bruce Springsteen, I just want Bruce Springsteen in the movie. I just want to hear what he has to say about everything, because the man's an amazing storyteller. And Elton John, I knew how important Tower was to him. And I figured if this was going to be the definitive Tower Records documentary, then I needed to have Elton John, because he was such a supporter of the store. He loved the store so much. He was actually quoted as saying if he had to do it all over again, the job that he would plug for the most would be a job at Tower Records. And so, you know, the people that we did go to all said yes. And they were all very specific reasons why I wanted them in that, so I can have them be part of the story as well, not just commenting on the story.
But it's finally, though, interestingly, a movie about the fact that real investment and love in what you do can actually get you, if you're lucky enough, a long way. I mean, because the story of finding that piece of property on Sunset,
yeah,
and just having a relative who could do this whole thing, and it was done for no money even then, with $70,000?
$70,000.
For that enormous store to lay all that stuff
it's
out.
It's incredible. And, you know, you always think that you see some great success and you think that there must have been some plan. And you realize, or at least I've realized, there's never a plan. There's just an extreme passion, and someone was just tenacious enough to not give up. And Russ is a good example of that.
Well, for example?
For example, letting someone else paint the fence. He calls it his Tom Sawyer theory. You hire someone smart, you let them do the job, you let them take ownership of it, and you do it together. You could just say that's the description of my relationship with my editor, with my writer, with my producers. And there's never a plan, or it never goes according to plan. There's going to be a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of it is going to be luck. But as long as you're persistent and as long as you just keep trying, maybe you'll be able to pull it off. And, you know, to find out that a company that did over $1 billion in business, that had 192 stores around the world, on five continents, that meant so much to so many thousands of people that worked there and millions of people that shopped there. To find out that that was how he ran that company, it made me feel like I could do almost anything, and at least I could make this documentary.
Colin, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Really, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got to come back again. We didn't even get to talk about your new show, for God's sakes.
And we'll do that's the EP. We'll do that as the EP.
Like a single. My guest is Colin Hanks. His first film as filmmaker, the great documentary All Things Must Pass. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's also the associate producer. I'm going to go buy some singles. It's the To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.